Well, I have a couple things I want to do. Did I get everything turned on over there? Yes, I did. We want to finish 7 and 8 in Robinson's book. We'll leave 9 and 10 for next Wednesday. I want to talk about some of the things that overlap public speaking. I was thinking about that, particularly when I was talking about the voice the other day and the use of it, and that would just be presentation issues. I think in some ways homiletics takes some of that for granted. As I said, I was always shocked at the beginning of class that just how much time was spent on other kinds of issues in preaching classes and textbooks. They talk about your relationship, once again, to the Word of God, to the congregation, these kinds of things, your role, but they don't spend a lot of time talking about your actual delivery. Now, some of that's coming up, of course. They tuck it into the end, but that's where it overlaps my teaching in public speaking, and I was thinking about that, thinking it's interesting. It's similar, but it's different. You're all doing really well, I think, just in terms of the presentation stuff. I haven't sat here cringing, thinking, oh, I'm going to somehow tell this person not to do this or not to do that. It seems to me you're all very fluid in front of a group of people and are pleasing, you know, to listen to in that sense. So I think we rightly spend our time on the organization, the sermon itself, not the delivery of it. So anyway, I want to go over a couple of those things from public speaking, talk about Haddon Robinson, then I want to get to the homiletic plot, the handout I gave you quite a while ago now, but I have a PowerPoint that goes with it. With all of this, say first of all that you'll be doing your repeat sermons Friday and Monday. I think the question for me is never, is it difficult to do? It's with public speaking or reworking something like this. Are you willing to do it? It's very easy just to assume you've done enough. And I think the person who's reaching for excellence in public speaking has to beat that attitude out of themselves. If you're a preacher, if you're taking people's time, you're the index of how well you love them, how much you care about, how seriously you take all this is how hard are you willing to work at it. So I say, rework these things. Find out where you think it's weak, where it can be improved, where it can be made better, and take the initiative to do it. I see that so often in public speaking. And also people level off in public speaking. They get to this place where they say, I'm doing well enough. And of course they are, but the great thing about any kind of preaching or public speaking is it can always be improved. I mean, there's no need to level off at any one place. You can just, your entire life. Age has this advantage in it that you can keep improving. But you wonder, some people seem probably hit their peak at 25 and never bothered to try to push it out to see if they could get better. I'd say keep pushing those things. All right, for public speaking and delivery and stuff, things I was thinking were overlapping here that I wanted to talk about first. One of them is, I said, we were talking about animation, and I said you will find that you automatically adjust a little bit to the ethos of the group you're speaking to. I don't know how, if you're preaching in a congregation that you know, that you're a part of, you know what that is, and you don't have to think about it. But if you get invited to a new congregation, it's really difficult to know what emotional pitch they operate at, or what would exactly be their level. You can sense it, but it's hard to get that, right? And it's hard to ask it bluntly. I don't know, if somebody invites you to preach somewhere, you might just describe your service, describe the way people approach it. Try to get the emotional tenor of the room so that you know where you are with it. I said that I'm teaching at two Sunday schools, two adult discipleship classes Sunday mornings, one here at Shiloh and one at our church, LCF, and Vicki commenting that I was much more animated at LCF than I was at Shiloh. And I think, well, it's not because I'm inhibited, it's because I think the ethos is a little closer, a little calmer. Once I went as a proxy for our bishop to a church, we were sharing a missionary with a church. It was a very Pentecostal kind of church, I guess you could say. Here were these clunky Mennonites in Mobile, Alabama, and this fellow's also shared with a group that's pretty lively. The bishop, they were going to commission the missionaries with a prayer, and the big Pentecostal church, they wanted some of the men, you know, a Mennonite to come over and give their blessing and participate in the service. Our bishop couldn't do it, so he sent me as his proxy. And it was so funny, because I'm not uncomfortable in that environment, but I'm not a wild worshiper. I tend to be really quiet, get the most out of quiet and worship. That's and I'm private on that level emotionally. So you get to this church and there's a dance group comes down the aisles and there, you know, the King David Dance Company and people are praying. A guy gets up and gives a spontaneous prophecy in tongues and it's got all the elements of it. And then it comes time for the prayer commissioning. And so you have this brother from the Mennonites who's come to also bless our missionary brother. And they get me up on stage in front of hundreds of people. And you can just tell that the minute I got out of my seat, though, I was like this wet blanket walking up to the thing. And they say, now he'll pray for our missionary. And so they hand me the microphone, and I begin to pray for the missionary. But as I'm praying, you could tell it's just too flat. And I remember I got toward the end of it, and his hand grabbed the microphone away from me and started really, really giving the prayer then, you know, just holding forth for the group. And I thought, I wasn't offended. I was just greatly amused. I thought the boring Mennonite got up to pray that morning. Fortunately, the pastor rescued him by grabbing the mic and he was going to, you know, slay the demons and conquer the kingdom of Satan. My clunky Mennonite prayer about blessing him and keeping him safe and spreading the word was just way too boring for this congregation. Anyway, it's an example to me of how you can, the emotional climate of a room can really change. Ask about it. It's worth figuring out. I was thinking of a couple things here. We started to talk about voice, and I said one of the things I thought you could probably all work on is the use of your voice. And if I can get it all on here, I will show you a PowerPoint that I use in public speaking class about voice. So if you were in public speaking, you've probably seen this. I think the key element here is change your voice. Don't go at the same pitch. And what are the elements that you can use? We had the quote there from Disraeli, there is no index of character as sure as the voice. If the eyes are the window to the soul, the voice is the front door. And this is from chapter 8 of my public speaking textbook. Vocal elements. Are you loud enough? And projecting is the issue. One of the problems, of, I said, is that we come from close-up media and good microphones. And so people take for granted that you can be heard and seen, but yet we're too subtle, especially for deep rooms. Remember, I was telling you about my friend who was used to speaking in front of a huge congregation. They put him in a little room. He seemed a little hyperkinetic until he could scale it down to the size of the room that was there. I would say still, though, even if you're mic'd, learn to project. I am on the other side of a gap here, so I had to speak in places where I had to bellow a little bit to be heard. I don't know that any of you are of the age where you've had to do that, so let them turn you down. In fact, even if the volume's steady, the fact that you're energizing your voice, you're pushing it out, will come across, even if the volume is controlled by a volume knob in the back of the room somewhere. But loud enough. And I say you probably aren't projecting enough. Projection's that idea of throwing it out. It's not just a question of loud. It's almost an attitude. You're pushing something out of yourself. Something's coming out of you're trying to bring it out of yourself on all levels. Well, I don't know how to describe it other than that. I mean, you'll know it when you feel it, I think, that whether you're just up there talking in a way that you could be being recorded and nobody would have to be in the room for you, as much as if you're actually trying to reach out to the last row, the last set of pews in the congregation. Rate. And remember we talked about, this would be the issue of speed. It's one of the few things you can do with your voice. And what we have there is must match emotional content. And when you're doing this, of course, you want to get fast when it's exciting. I don't think I would get fast just to get over details. If you have something you want to just race through because you want to get to your main point, I'd say that would probably be a good place to improve your message by cutting that part out. You shouldn't really have anything in there. You just want to blast through quickly without any consideration. That's sort of the, okay, I'm going to talk about this really fast because it doesn't really matter all that much. Well, just leave that out. Go to your main point. But if you speed up because it's exciting or slow down because you want to do emphasis, that works very much. Diction. You've heard me in public speaking classes undoubtedly talk about this. Never mispronounce a name, but if you do, do it confidently. Where's this going to be a real problem with you with preaching? What's that? genealogies, names. My guess is all you can do is blast through it if you don't know. But if you rehearse and you get a pronouncing Bible, you'll be able to do it. And you'll find actually sometimes some things are routinely mispronounced even by a Bible pronunciation guide. At that point, you might want to just go with the flow. If people are saying Zebulun and the dictionary says Zebulon, you might want to just go with Zebulun. Otherwise, people will be wondering who you are and why you're pronouncing it that way. I told you that my associate pastor was making great fun of me at one point for saying Habakkuk, because Habakkuk was always the way he did it. And I thought, where did I come up with that? And then I found out when I was listening, I forget who it was. It might have even been Phil Barr, or it was one of the Englishmen here. I thought, wow, my first pastors, there were lots of Englishmen around, and that's where I learned it. You know, Habakkuk. But he thought it was just hysterical the first time I said, like, how could somebody who's been, you know, in ministry mangle a name that badly? Well, I don't know how I did that, you know, but I found out. The Brits did it to me. Did Phil say that?
How do you, like, Maccabees, how do you say that?
Well, I would say Maccabees.
He always put a B on the end.
Maccabees? Now that may just be an eccentricity. I don't know. The terrible thing is, once you start doing that in life, you get glued to it, and you say it even when you don't want to say it. Pitch. What is pitch exactly? I'm not really sure. In my public speaking class, I said, avoid droning. You can get there. Droning is talking, you know, in a sing-songy way that just keeps going, and the fancy word might be soporific. Soporific means that you're putting people to sleep with what you're saying. It becomes hypnotic because it's droning. 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 I'm waiting to see if your eyelids start to drop here with this. Nasality, that's a tricky one, because some people do have kind of a nasal voice, and you don't know what to do. You can't change their voice for them. But there are some people who have kind of an affected nasal voice, and I think you might want to draw it back down if you can. I'm not really sure what the vocal coaches say, but I suppose things that are up in your head, they sound like they're coming from the chin up, are they lack the resonance, the sonorous quality that something that's coming from the chest and the throat up. I don't know, you'd have to consult somebody about that, but I know it when I hear it. There's a person who has that full voice that's coming up from their chest, and there's that person who has that head voice. Have you run into that with singing?
No, I just have that. There's somebody who's a song leader. He's twangy and nasally.
A twangy song leader. A twang. Don't create questions. That's what I talked about with in public speaking. I don't know. Do you remember anything about that? What do you remember?
I was thinking there was a word for it. Like, so are you ending with pitch going up, or are you ending with level or going down?
Right.
Like, level or going down sounds like a statement. Going up sounds like your head.
Very good. And let's just look at this for a minute. If you have a sentence and it's all these words, I remember when I studied linguistics and phonology, and who knows how that's moved since the mid-1970s when I was doing it. But this had a fancy word. It was, I think, called the supra-segmental phonetic structure of a sentence. It was not how a word came together, but how a sentence sounded. And that every language has a kind of a rhythm or a phonetic pattern in their speech. They say that English tends to be an iambic. Do you know iambic pentameter from both Shakespeare and the blues? Da-da, 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 da-da. That tends to be our approach. There are other languages that have a different kind of meter to it. But it's often said that American blues and Shakespeare both use iambic pentameter. So every once in a while you'll hear somebody take like a line out of Shakespeare and wail it out in a blues song, and it matches, you know, even though it's Elizabethan English. Fascinating to hear. In any event, there's a supra-segmental, I mean over top of everything, way of doing things. You could be flat. But flat can be boring, right? I mean, you want it to move a little bit. A falling inflection at the end, that may be a rising and falling inflection are the issues here. Often those are marked by a comma in a text. A comma is either a pause, a rising or a falling inflection. At least phonetically, that's how it'll often work out. And so when you're reading things or looking even in your own text, you might want to put it there. But there's, probably in public speaking told you, German language tends to be pretty flat and go down at the end. American stuff tends to go up and down a lot. But the rising inflection at the end of a sentence begins to make everything sound like a question. And everything seems to start going that way. And you don't know, really, is the person asking me a question? Or are they making a statement? Or what are we saying here about the gospel? You know how that goes? They just continually raise the inflection. And I said, with risk of being sounding sexist, it tends to be a feminine trait in my experience with speech. It's a fascinating thing that you can study in speech. There's the generation of women that's a little older than you, and they study a lot about vocal burnout, vocal fry at the end of the sentence. There's sort of a style thing that goes on with women probably just, 10 years older than you, and it's a very interesting thing. Look at, you might find it on YouTube or someplace like that. Study the vocal burnout or vocal fry. And it's a way of flattening speech, and apparently it's attractive within a generation. People really choose to change their speech with this kind of stuff. Anyway, it's very interesting to look at that and see where you stand with it. Phrasing and pauses, short sentences of one thought, then pause. That would be another thing, is to really make use. That's one thing I've learned preaching and public speaking, is to make better use of pauses. Get desperate because you want to say a lot to people, and so you think everything needs to be said and crowded in there, but that's a good time to edit and cut things from your sermon. Pauses really help audiences. They emphasize points and they give a chance for people to catch up, to grasp what you said, that the last thing that just came out of your mouth is very important, right? I mean, you just can't help but think, what did that guy just say? what did that person just say? Variety. Consciously change your pace, tone, loudness. Look for wandering attention. And I told you that Monday as well. The idea of, you look around the room and see, are you missing anybody? Address them. You don't want to put them on the spot or embarrass them, but you can find pockets of wandering attention. If you see one of them, look at that corner of the room and change your pace and see if you don't draw some people in. It's you'll welcome this if you're a listener. It helps you. It helps you stay with a speaker. From your instructor now, this was from public speaking again, which you must practice and rehearse. Students and most speakers underestimate the need for rehearsal, standing, and using the voice you plan to use in the speech. And that's public speaking again, not preaching, but I think it applies equally well. If you sit at your desk with a manuscript and just say things under your breath, you're not really rehearsing the message in its totality. You may be getting the content and the flow and imagining some things, but it's only when you stand up and actually deliver it in your normal voice that it comes across. I said my pattern is, I always do that twice before I preach a sermon. Every sermon's been preached two times before I'm in a pulpit. And I'll stand in front of a dresser. I've used music stands, whatever I can prop things on. Back when I lived in a little house and my kids were out there, I'd just turn on a classical radio station loud, so it would be screening them out and they'd be screening me out, and I would, in the bedroom, deliver the sermon. I remember one time the kids came up to Vicky and said something like, "What's Dad doing? There's this weird music and some guy speaking." "Dad's just rehearsing his sermon, don't worry." They probably got used to it, but I can't recommend it enough. So there are cultures where they don't do that level of pre-planning and messages, but I do. So every message I've ever given, I think, ever, really, as a pastor, has been delivered twice. That seems to clinch it for me. First time through, I'll maybe pause and just scratch something out or write something on my manuscript, but it's that second time through that now it's ready to go. And often I've got that done by Friday or Saturday. I don't wait till the very last minute with that kind of thing. Practice and experiment. When should I speed up? Speak softly. Get loud. Speak slowly. Change tone. That's what you're looking for, as it matches the content of your message. So that's one from public speaking. I had a couple others that are tied to what's coming up in Robinson. Let's do them here from this public speaking standpoint first. Once again, if you've had my class, you've seen these PowerPoints before. Where did we go? In particular, the chapters coming up talk about introductions and conclusions in Robinson. And so I just want to see what's the parallel with when we do this in public speaking. When you had a PowerPoint at the very beginning of this course, so you may not like this, but I included some of these same things. Audience questions you must answer in your opening. That they're making this appraisal of you the minute you stand up. Now, if you're a regular pastor and speaker in a congregation, it's a little different because they know you. But you might be surprised at how fine-tuned their sense is about your emotional condition since they know you week by week. They might already be sensing that before you ever get up to speak. You think, oh, what's up today? Is this person charged up and in a good mood or in a bad mood? It's still happening, even though you're the weekly speaker. Audience questions you must answer in your opening. Does the speaker care about me and my situation? Well, that has to be answered every week, doesn't it? By a pastor. I mean, you could say this message just doesn't pertain to me. This person doesn't understand me. I'm going to tune this one out. It's a bad morning. Is the speaker credible? What does that mean? Yeah. Credibility is believability. Can you believe them? Now, on a weekly basis, what would that mean for a pastor? You say, generally speaking, that they don't dislike you as a pastor, but what would it mean in terms of an individual sermon? Credibility is believability. That's what it means to be credible. Now, you think, well, generally speaking, you would think your pastor in your church is a credible individual. But on a sermon-by-sermon basis, what might be the problem with credibility?
I guess one thing, if you say if he's preaching on something, and something that he maybe not has much, hasn't had experience in, and he's read books about it, then I'm like, sitting here, well, I've done this for 15 years, and would that maybe be part of this?
Yes, very much so. I mean, there would be both ways, right? There would be the person who's only read about it, the person who hasn't read about it. But in other words, you don't invest a lot of confidence in what they're saying about the topic, because how would they possibly know? There's some things that experience can teach you and some things that books can teach you, but the powerful combination, I think, is when you've done both. You've lived it and you've studied it. You'll find this. You'll probably go through this stage. One of the most difficult groups on earth to pastor are young parents. I mean, they're circling the wagons. They're very, very protective of their domain, and they're not really open to a lot of leadership in a lot of cases. They're insecure and defensive. They might respond really well to some messages about parenting, but you get to be a little old. You've raised kids through their teenage years and seen them go to college or do things like that, and you get younger parents making pronouncements about parenting and family life. You tend to almost get amused. You think, okay, you'll see, you'll learn. It doesn't. 14 changes things a lot, you know, in a home. And so if somebody's speaking, you think, well, they have great authority if they're still at the age where they're shepherding 5 and 6 year olds. God bless them. You know, you've been through it and you don't need a big pedantic speech on it, but you're kind of tolerant of the idea that there has to be a sermon that brings in that level of family life. But if they start to get exuberant and suggest they know the pattern and where it's going to go, you'll find all the older people in the congregation just, okay. Okay. We're glad you have this confidence or this perspective in life at this point. But it might not continue that way. You understand? They're not credible to you. They haven't gone far enough down the road to be extending their message as far as it goes. Be very careful what your limits are there. Does the speaker have something to say worth listening to? And that's going to be sermon by sermon. Even if they give you the benefit of the doubt, I like my pastor, he usually says something pretty good. Still, in the introduction, they're probably making the determination, is this sermon for me? Or is it really being aimed at someone else? And by the way, don't ever aim a sermon at a person or a problem in the congregation that's just specific like that, because you will invariably find that you shoot the arrow at the target and it flies over the backstop and stabs somebody in the back row who's not even on your mind. Most pastors will tell you this. If there's a pastoral problem in a small area of congregational life, deal with it pastorally, personally. Don't get up and preach about it in the pulpit. If you do, the people you're trying to address won't hear it. They won't even know you're addressing them. But there will be other people who for some reason are sensitive and feel like you've shot at them. You know, what did I do? It's classic. It's a classic rookie mistake in preaching and pastoring at the same time. Yeah.
What's the interplay between responding to, and maybe you already answered this, responding to a situation in the church, maybe that's not one small isolated part of it, but it's kind of a whole church issue in speaking to it, but not doing that, not trying to shoot anybody with it.
I think that's very appropriate to know the pulse of your own congregation and speak to the issues that affect the whole congregation. If you think something toxic is happening in a corner of the church and is likely to affect other people, it might be great to prep them. But if you set an alarmist tone, you might do more damage than good. It would probably be good to just seize the high ground and talk about what you're thinking, not even mention that there could be a problem or an issue nipping at your heels, but just paint a bigger picture, a positive picture, and let people go to it. But it seems to me like if you just sort of say, there's something bad happening here and I don't want it to infect you, you'll find there are, A, some people are thick and some people are oversensitive, but I mean, it usually doesn't work real well. But if you paint the picture of what Christ might want, what a church at its finest might be like, then that works. In preaching, I think. It's amazing to me, though, as I said, this image of shooting over the backstop. It is remarkable sometimes how you can zing somebody that is just totally not on your mind. You've hurt them, really, with a sermon. And you thought, I wasn't really thinking about you or your situation at all. If anything, I was thinking about something else. But I'd be very careful about zeroing in on problems, I said, and I found that any time I've done that, people didn't know I was speaking to them anyway. I look for a more positive word from the Lord for the whole congregation, and if there's a problem in a group in the congregation, it would be best just to go talk to those people as a pastor, not try to preach at them. That's a less than pastoral way to do it to me. Okay, here are openings. Now, Robinson will have his own set of openings, but the openings we talk about in public speaking are refer to your subject directly. You'll get that, of course. Now, he's going to talk a little bit about that in terms of deductive and inductive approaches and where they go. A story, joke, or anecdote, he talks about humor and said, well, you know, be careful. Obviously, the role of humor is more limited in the pulpit. You'll find that humor is a difficult one to manage in a sermon, because not everybody understands your jokes, and a lot of jokes just wouldn't be appropriate for a common bond. Now, we talked about this in public speaking in terms of probably speaking to a group of people who don't know you. You probably don't. That's not really important for a preacher in the sense of they know who you are. The common bond might be on the theme. Why are we in this situation spiritually together? In other words, well, it's not that I have it together and you don't, and now I will impart godly wisdom to you, but that we stand in this same situation with God as spiritual beings. How do we have it together? Honest compliments, humor, as I said, those things are probably more appropriate to my public speaking students than to this. Also, they have a thesis moment. And I've been trying to think about this one with preaching, this particular idea. Now, in public speaking, you'd say you have this introduction, but there's this point where the introduction turns into the body of the speech. Robinson doesn't really have a moment like that, I don't think, that he talks about, or at least not one I was ferreting out there. But it's you might consider it. Think about when you're reworking your sermon, where's the introduction? Draw a line right across the page and say, here's the introduction, here's the body. This is where the line is. And see what is the first thing that signals to the congregation we're out of the introduction now. Here's my topic. I think, if anything, Robinson might have that with the scripture reading part that he talks about, which is in, that might already be in chapter 9. I can't remember. But maybe that would be the thing to do there, to think about what is it that signals the congregation. Introductory stuff is now over. We're at the meat of it. And think of what you put there. In public speaking, again, it has three functions. It tells the audience what kind of, once again, now we might say, sermon to expect. It sets the tone and indicates how you will proceed. There's probably something going on right past that line that does that for you, don't you think? I'm going to guess. Think about where it is. When you're reworking the sermon, see if you slash a line across the page and say, oh, there it is. Now, do people know I'm now at the heart of my, you know, or at the function of it? Okay. We don't need this. There was one other one that I thought from public speaking would be intriguing to look at in light of Robinson's chapters. Closing a speech. And once again, we're talking about a sermon here. The rules, I think, are good. End on time, end with conviction, end on target. Tell them you are ending and do it. That's my public speaking advice, and I don't see why it wouldn't apply in homiletics as well. Robinson will go into this a little bit, and you'll see it. He says words like finally, in conclusion, and things like that can really mess you up. If you say those words and people think you're galloping down the home stretch and you don't go down it, you've got problems, because they've already only assigned so much mental energy to hearing it. He's saying, well, perhaps those words aren't, Robinson will say this, we'll get to it when we look at it, maybe those aren't really good words anyway in a sermon. Maybe those should be very infrequent terms, because issues aren't settled finally in a sense with the scripture. I mean, you've invited people to a place, but it's not over with the sermon, right? And so maybe that whole phraseology should be eliminated. One of the biggest problems you'll find is that people introduce new topics at the end of their message. Start telling you about what they didn't tell you and how they'll get to it, or just what we didn't get to talk about, or they take a wild shot and they send things off in a different direction. That's bad planning. Be sure, as I said, finish strong. The end of a message is when you should really be able to look up, look at the congregation, and speak directly to them. That last sentence in particular, if you're reading it or you're fading out at that point, I think you're robbing the moment of a lot of its emotional power. He has five techniques. Once again, now these are probably a stretch for what we're doing. Brief stories, quotations, or ringing phrases, poems. We've had that, though. Angie had a singing Jesus Loves You. You had a hymn at the end of one of yours, didn't you? Yeah. Examples, summarize. We'll see what Haddon Robinson has to say about those. Anyway, I was very impressed in these couple of chapters in Robinson, how it connects with the public speaking thing. So, if we got chapter 7 there, and I want to finish that chapter. Everybody open to it? Once again, what I'll do is just sort of march through here the things I thought were very intriguing. Of course, I quoted to you yesterday, or Monday, 143 at the bottom, a mist in the pulpit can easily become a fog in the pew. I thought that was a good remark, although I'm trying to remember what it exactly he says about this. So one of the few things you can do with an idea, right, is restate it or explain it. He's saying explanation is harder than you think. 144, he talks about facts, factual information, and how to handle it, and says much that parades as fact is opinion in disguise. I'm on 144, first full paragraph. As a matter of fact, a preacher says, the greatest threat to the morality of America is the television set. Of course, that is not a matter of fact at all, only a matter of opinion. Now, I wouldn't quibble over that as an expression, as a matter of fact. People will probably cut you enough leeway to say, in your opinion, it's a matter of fact. But it depends a little on how you deliver it and how you're using that particular phraseology. Statistics are a special form of fact that enable us to survey a large amount of territory very quickly. This is the last full paragraph there. They are particularly appealing to citizens in numbers conscious society. What's the primary thing? Like, when you're preaching and you want to establish a point, it's really easy to think of statistics. as being, you know, a real authority. Now, one thing we know in public speaking is don't snow people with statistics. One statistic and then painted with a lot of imagery, not just, you know, 60% of marriages end in divorce, or, you know, 40% of comic book readers turn into heroin addicts, or whatever it might be. You know, it could be a, but to repaint that in terms of imagery that people know, that would be as if, you know, remember the beautiful trees on our campus. If you cut down, you know, this many of them, imagine the campus. You've done that. Paint the picture. Don't give a list of 10 statistics. Use the one most powerful statistic and give it visual power by illustrating it various ways. But there's always one problem with statistics that everybody ought to keep in mind if they're using that to support their point. What is it? Do you know? There's one issue with all statistics, that using them to establish your point, that everybody always ought to keep in mind about the limits of a statistical argument. It's going to be very important if you're preaching and using a statistic to support an idea of yours. 80% of all Christians don't ever read their Bible during the week. That's because they watch too much television, or, you know, whatever. Well, you could do a guilt trip. This is probably a bad leading question. Statistics, you know what they are, right? I mean, you know a statistic when you hear it. Statistics prove only one thing: correlation between factors. Correlation between factors means, and one of the classic ones was summer weather and robbery rates are correlated. The higher the temperature, the more burglary there is. There's a correlation between these factors. Statistically, that is unarguable. Right? But the thing is, it isn't causation. These are big words, but I mean, you should always have this in the back of your mind with anything anybody's doing statistically. Correlation does not equal causation. It's not true that hot weather causes robbery. It is only true that during hot weather, robbery rates go up. Statistics can never prove that one causes the other, only that they're seen side by side. So there's always, always, always that limitation in a statistical argument. Correlation does not mean causation. The joke here was ice cream sales were high during hot weather and burglary rates are high during hot weather. So can you say ice cream consumption causes burglary? Well, it's absurd, right? Why? There would be always the chance when you have the causation thing. Now, it's okay to speculate, but you can't say it proves. It doesn't. Statistics will never prove it. They will never satisfy it. You can say this causes that statistically, but everybody has to step back and say there's always one issue that maybe explains it better, and it's called the intervening variable. The intervening variable is that other thing that might actually be figuring it out. For instance, cancer rates go up in industrial societies. Say, well, is that because of industrial pollution? Well, one of the intervening variables were people lived longer in industrial societies and cancer rates go up with age. And so you're saying, well, it might not be that people are healthier in places where there's not like a modern society. It could just be they don't live as long. People die of infectious diseases earlier that aren't killing people in Norway. So as they live longer, they get more cancer or something like that. The intervening variable here between ice cream and robbery might be what? Do you have a guess? It's a classic example. Hot weather and burglary. Well, people leave their doors and windows open in hot weather. There are more crimes of opportunity. You don't want to roll up your car window. You don't want to close your hard door and lock it. You know, this kind of stuff. So, of course, burglar goes up. Now, once again, that's still, all that is correlation, right? It doesn't prove causation. There could always be another intervening variable that some smarty comes along and says, aha, but have you considered? It could be this. Anyway, I like this. When you look at Haddon Robinson, 144, statistics are a special form of facts enable us to survey a large territory quickly, particularly appealing to our citizens. Let's see. Where does he say? An air of certainty hangs over the decimal point or the fractionalized percentage, even where measurement is unknowable, absurd. A classic illustration is a report made years ago that one-third of all women students at Johns Hopkins University had married faculty members. The percentage was accurate. Johns Hopkins only had 3 women students at the time, and one of them married a faculty member. There you get his ideas. Quotations. Let me just ask you, do you find quotations, I'm thinking not biblical quotations, do you find these useful in sermons?
Not very
used. One of them goes a long way. Every once in a while you'll find a preacher who strings them together in great detail, and I don't appreciate that, but one of them goes pretty well. You use Tozer, for example. I like that. I'm forgetting if you used quotations from anybody. Who?
Or Charles Erdman.
Oh, yeah, you did. That's right. Yeah, you did. I think a good quote. I'm not so usually looking. Now he's talking about why would you quote somebody. Who says something makes a difference, and sort of using it as a question of authority. I don't think it's so much that you want to bring in a heavy gun to pound people with. I think it's just that some people have said something just really well. You're not going to say it as well as they said it. Maybe it's a little flowery. Maybe it's a little more poetic. But it seems to me if you pause, you read it slowly, pause, it's just so articulate. You think, that's it. You know, I'm not going to say it that well. And that's what I'm looking for. More than authority, I'm looking for that just fabulous turn of phrase that might stay with someone. We got to narration. Narration takes on energy when your verbs and nouns paint pictures in your listener's mind. Use dialogue. The gospel narratives and parables are filled with it. Put words into people's mouths. And then on 151, narration means communicating with imagination, and imagination reflects the insights of faith. He talks about illustrations. Illustrations also make truth believable. Logically, of course, examples cannot stand as proof, but psychologically they work with our argument to gain acceptance. That's 152, and that's a middle paragraph there. Very important. If you're being analytical of another person's argument, beware of this, because an illustration sometimes takes on a life of its own, and it's all powerful to say, that illustrates, that doesn't prove. In particular, if somebody pulls another scripture in on you, you say it might be an illustration of what you mean, but using scripture illustratively is very different than using scripture to prove a point. And so be careful with that when you're working with narrative portions. Let's see, what else did I underline on 157? Just because I thought it was amusing. Pastors of rural churches who grew up in the city must learn as much as possible about farmers and farming if they expect to illustrate their sermons effectively for their congregations. And then later down that paragraph, a minister who grew up on a farm and is speaking to an urban congregation can tell a story about delivering a calf so vividly that even a city audience can identify with it. You get the feeling here he's going one direction. And I think I was mentioning to somebody after class, I think probably the more likely scenario in the Mennonite world is that the person who grows up in a rural environment is going to be talking to the city audience and thinking, well, yeah, use the images of your background, the power they have, but usually you're not going to be the city born and bred pastor at a rural congregation. You're going to be the rural background person at the city congregation. And, it would be best to be careful with that. I got to page 160 and I drew a whole line down that list of bullet points here, for illustrations. Must be true. Should be modest. Congregations dislike first-person stories when the preacher emerges regularly as a hero. That is a very important point. Look at all the, particularly books on marriage or psychological things, they're often self-referential, not reverential, but referential, the way they did it. And somehow the way they did it is always right. You think, it's strange. when somebody keeps coming back around to that, that their example is the shining one. I'd say, well, Paul says, imitate me, but Reuben Sayers rarely says, imitate me. There are some things I do right, and there are a lot of things I do wrong, but I get very weary of self-referential pastoring sermons, talking about the way it's done in their family, the way this person's arrived at victory. I think, well, you know, everybody's at war here, you know, and I'm happy to hear about your victories, but I it seems like somebody's too self-absorbed if they're always referring to themselves and their struggles. I'd rather have them step out of it. Third rule that must be scrupulously observed when using personal illustrations is that you must not violate a confidence. A pastor of mine early on had grown up as the daughter of it was a husband-wife pastoral team in this church, and she'd grown up as the daughter of a Mennonite bishop, and said that often he referenced his kids in his sermons, and she said she really didn't like it. And so she and her husband had determined not to reference their children in sermons. That it just never worked for him, you know. I can see it both ways, but I took that advice. I rarely ever referred to my own children in sermons. I think they'll tell their own stories their own way. The end of page 161, he talks about the importance of file keeping, and I just drew a big smiley face over it. I think it's the most embarrassingly old-fashioned thing I've heard yet out of Robinson. He's got you keeping index cards in a file and even telling you about how to alphabetize them and things like that. And then goes on in the last paragraph to say, this is the 21st century. yeah, hadn't, and you're not really in it, I don't think. I don't know anybody who keeps a file box of cards. God bless you if you do. I just think electronic environments are just not like that anymore. They haven't been that way the whole time I've been preaching. I've pretty much probably stowed things on a disk or something I wanted to keep, emailed it to myself or something like that. I just found the whole thing amusing, but I don't know. Maybe you don't. What's that?
The way he talks about the computer, it makes it sound like, and then there's something called a computer, and you can keep stuff on there.
This book was written in 1980. We can forgive him then for writing it, but he was updated and republished, 2001? I think he needed to rework the end of chapter 7 a little bit more. Now, if we can just charge ahead to 8, start with a bang. This is where we got his introduction and ending stuff here, preparing the introduction and conclusion. Introductions and conclusions have a significance in a sermon out of proportion to their length. That's his opening statement. And it talks about, I think, the personal element. Remember that common bond issue we talked about? On 166, when he gets right to the end of his introduction, he says, in the final analysis, listeners do not hear a sermon, they hear you. And I think that's intriguing. And I don't know if it was in Robinson here or somewhere else, but they were talking about polling pastors about preaching that mattered to them. And they could come up with a list of three preachers that were very influential in their life, but could not mention three sermons any one of them gave. Is that in Robinson? Or have I read that in another book? We did it at the beginning. Did I fish that out of later in the book? I've lost track of it. I've read too many books this year on preaching. But that's the idea, that you really do remember preachers, not sermons, right? It's hard to remember specific sermons. I remember preachers very well that have a great influence on me, but any specific message of theirs, man, I can hardly call them up in my mind at all. Yeah, I hope you're right. I know I read it somewhere in the last year, and I thought it was a really interesting idea. It's interesting that he puts it here in the introduction. We talked about that idea of common bond. Commanding attention. I'm down in effective introduction commands attention. If you do not capture attention in the first 30 seconds, you may never gain it at all. Producers of television dramas know this well. Once again, that corresponds with what we've studied in public speaking. Over 167, the bullet points start with a paradox. Use a familiar thought in an unfamiliar setting. Rhetorical questions, reach for attention. A startling fact, a provocative comment about your text, a touch of humor. I didn't know about his next bullet point. Your passage can be the basis of attention. Yes, I think you probably always need to say something about your passage. I didn't know if he needed a bullet point there. All of us sit up and listen to the prospect of a story. I said a story is a good way to open, and you will drive directly at some subjects, refer directly. That was also in my public speaking PowerPoint. I liked his next idea. An effective introduction uncovers needs. Why should this be listened to? And that section, 168, 169, is worth it. And 170, here's one of those illustrations perhaps Zach likes. When the flint of a person's problem strikes the steel of the Word of God, a spark ignites that burns the mind. You have the underline. Very good. That's one I singled out too. Well, the thing I like about him is he's original with all this stuff. Is that even if I roll my eyes when I get to think, okay, I appreciate the fact that it's not canned, so it makes you think about it again. Once again, this matched my stuff from introductions. 171, top paragraph. Early in the sermon, therefore, your listeners should realize that you are talking to them about themselves. You raise a question, probe a problem, identify a need, open up a vital issue to which the passage speaks. And application starts in the introduction. Now, he goes into the various ways of doing this in the next few pages. If your sermon is to develop inductively, your introduction only introduces the first point, and then you link it to your second point with a strong transition and move it down the line that way. An inductive sermon, your complete idea emerges only in the final moment of the movement of the sermon. And then he has the other characteristics. Look at 173. This is another thing I teach in public speaking. Middle paragraph there. When we use an apology, so don't. Another thing about apologies, don't open your sermon with an apology. When we use an apology, we hope to win sympathy, but at best we gain pity. A congregation is seldom persuaded by someone for whom they feel sorry. If you're ill prepared, you've been sick that week, if you know everything's flown apart in your life, it's not a good place to start a sermon. We talked about it in public speaking in terms of self-handicapping remarks. I think I handed out an article from a speech professor at the University of South Alabama that was in Psychology Today, that the person who stands up and says, I've had a cold all week, or I hope I make sense because I've had the flu, or my dog died yesterday, or whatever it is, it is self-handicapping. It does not play well for those who feel they can study this and get some feedback from people as to how it plays out. So avoid self-handicapping, apologizing remarks. He has the thing on humor on 174. I drew a line by it as an important paragraph to work with, too. Oh, yeah.
Great introduction, and then the rest of the sermon's like, well, that was not very attractive.
I've heard that, too. Now, I don't have a specific... I've heard people gave me an introduction. I thought, this is going to be great. And then about halfway through, I realize they're not delivering on the promise. You know? They didn't get there. They had the text reading. I've harped on reading your scripture text as a very important moment in the script, in a sermon, and to really make it count, humor. And then he goes with his conclusion, and I liked his line on 176, like an able lawyer, a minister asks for a verdict. That you don't just leave people hanging, you ask for a verdict. And he does a summary, an illustration, a quotation, a question, and a prayer. That would be equivalent of the list I put up there where I had ringing phrases and poems, but I mean, this is more about a sermon. When he talks about that verdict, it's interesting. On 179, he says, although some people stumble over biblical truth because they ask the question, why? And maybe you haven't satisfied that for them. He says, far more fail to apply biblical truth to their lives because they cannot answer the question, how? And I think that would be a good advice to take. And at the bottom of that same section above visualization, at times the only proper response to a great biblical text is to fall down and worship. I told you this at the beginning of the class. I felt like Mennonite preaching, more than most preaching I've been around, seems to have to get a little heavy-handed at the end. It always comes around to what you're doing wrong and have to stop doing, or what you need to start doing right away, and it gets heavy, like they're making me do something here. Sermons in my other life of traditions, preaching, often left it with not what you need to stop doing or you need to start doing, but what has God done? And you sit at the end, it's what God is doing, what God has done, and you kind of bask in it. And you leave real energized spiritually. But I kind of have always waited. Mennonite preachers could never leave it there. It's like there's always this fist coming out behind, like, and you better start, or you better stop. And you're boom, boom. You know, and suddenly what was the glory of God's become a little too, I don't know, narrow or something like that. I don't know. I mean, I feel like probably find a balance, but just remember there may be somebody like me in the congregation who really can enjoy just basking in what God is doing or what God has done, and I don't need to be told, I'll connect the dots in my life. You know, what that might mean for me, I'll work out. But for the moment, I want to just bask in God's glory. Then on 181, he has the finally stuff that we talked about. Maybe those words shouldn't use. That's the very end of the paragraph. Andrew, are you able to follow, since you're in a different edition of the book, the ones I'm covering?
Yeah, it's just like a few things I don't have, because he added like a page or two in there and stuff. So it's a few things that I don't have, but maybe 95% of anything.
You can catch them, because I know in the midterm I pretty much asked you the stuff I've done. If you want to borrow, I almost always highlight or underline. If you want to borrow my book and try to match things, that's fine. Okay. Especially when we get to the finals, make sure you know which ones I did, because you'll be able to suspend the way I've been working on it. We'll have a final, yeah. So who's going to go preaching? Who's preaching Friday? You? Well, you have to go either the Friday or Monday. I don't think we determined an order.
I think I did Monday.
That's right. You. I remember you said you didn't want me. Do you want to do your repeat on Friday or Monday?
I think I'm going to do it on Friday, because I have a chapter speak on Monday.
So you'll do it Friday?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll have you. Let me look at I'm determined to get to Lowry here, and so I'm going to go to this. We probably won't be able to get through it. I handed you this as a handout, and I like it. Eugene Lowry, The Homiletical Plot. And he talks about it like a TV show or a movie. He uses a lot of those illustrations. This is a very influential book about narrative preaching as the wave of the future. We've got it in the library. I found this book fascinating. Now, he's not kind of the conservative evangelical voice here, although he's not off the charts with what he's doing at all, I don't think. I found it a very enjoyable book to read, and I'm still working on how to apply it to my own preaching, but I would pay attention to this. Now, I gave you a little bit of him. There's the book. From the foreword, in the case of sermon plots, he talks about it, the sermon is a plot, a narrative has a plot, right, the storyline, which always move from itch to scratch, that need thing that Robinson, I think, was talking about, that's there. The various stages along the way appear sequentially set. Now, he has a set pattern for them here in his plot development, but right at the end he says, but don't get enslaved to my method here. They're, often indeed they are. Truth is, however, there are some possible variations of movement, particularly related to stage 3, disclosing the clue to resolution, and 4, experiencing the good news. Now, this I'm not going to go through, but remember that I gave you this and you had these loops and how he's reworked them over the years. Plot resolutions. He talks about this, and he talks about it in terms of TV shows that are kind of dated. I don't think you'll relate to his illustrations there. I mean, he's well older than I am, I think, and I don't watch that kind of TV anyway, so I don't know, but he said, felt discrepancy, unknown resolution, felt discrepancy, known conclusion. The homiletical plot must catch people in the depths of the awful discrepancies of their world, social and personal. So you're starting the story like on a TV show. Here's the situation, and it's bad. You know, and you've caught them there. Now you say, You feel it. We all feel it, this struggle in our life, the scripturally that we're working on. Now, we don't know where you'll end up. He said, well, sometimes you do know where you'll end up. For example, on a weekly TV show, he says, you know the hero's not going to die. So that when you're developing the narrative, you know they have to be there next Thursday night to save the world again. You know, so it's not a question of leading somewhere they don't know. You know in the end this is going to happen. It's just you enjoy watching them. How are they going to get out of this scrape now? You know, it looks bad, but all the while you're suspending disbelief. You know the show isn't going to end that Thursday night. The protagonist has to live for next week, right? Anyway, what's that? Are you?
I said the Deuce Hazard is John Carter and the Deuce and her hero.
What's that?
It was a TV show.
Which one was it?
The Deuce.
Oh, yeah. always get away. Then they're back next week. They love that show in the South. I mean, it had long since been off.
No, it's not great. I can find joy, but it is a bit cheesy.
Yeah, in Southern culture, there weren't all that many TV shows that celebrated Southern culture, and so they were really proud of them, you know, in the South. They identified with, to me, it looked kind of rednecky, and, you know, I wasn't a Southerner, but I learned, you don't, and the other one you don't want to fool with is Mayberry, Andy Taylor, that stuff. I mean, that's like an article of religious faith in the South. I mean, you do not mock that show. You will be a social outcast of all time. They say that one of the reasons it was effective is that it came out in the 60s. There's all this racial stuff going on. The South was always looking bad. Everything was tense. And here, this gentle show of a town, and it makes everybody look good. And it just was such a relief for everybody. Like, all the Southerners weren't like the evil, segregationist, horrible people that were being seen on the Northern news. You know, there was another side to life, you know. And oh, they were into it. Well, I'm out of time. I'm going to keep pushing this. We are getting back to this, though. I like his book, and I like what he does. We'll be going through his various stages. See you Friday.